Good morning. This is Focus 580 WILL AM's daily call-in program. And this morning, my name is Rita Schulte. I'm sitting in for David Inge, who's away for a day or two. Our guest this morning will be Frank Ascione, professor in the Department of Psychology at Utah State University and the author of many books, including Safe Haven for Pets, Guidelines for Programs, Sheltering Pets for Women Who Are Battered. First, I'd like to say thank you to our senior producer, Harriet Williamson, our associate producer, Martha Deal, and our technical director, Henry Frayne. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite you to call us during the program with your questions or comments. Our number locally is 217-333-9455. If you live out of the 217 area code, you can call us toll-free at 800-222-9455. Professor Ascione, good morning and welcome.
Good morning to you, Rita. How are you?
I'm well, and I hope as well.
I am, yes.
We were discussing early this morning what a potentially dark and difficult subject cruelty to animals and cruelty to children and intimate partner abuse can be. We tend to look away frequently and don't know what to do. But what was impressive about your research and the outcome of the research is that you had said in one of your monographs how people came to you and asked for a solution and that you had actually come up with some ideas about pet sheltering as well.
That's correct. And I think that that kind of translation of the research findings into some programs that can assist victims of domestic violence, whether it's women alone or women and their children, is one of the hopeful things mm-hmm. that kind of keeps me going in this area. Mm-hmm. But I should say that the Safe Havens for Pets was not my idea.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is something that had been going on quite informally throughout a number of shelters for domestic violence victims mm-hmm. around the country. Because many of the operators of the shelters realized that sometimes women will not leave their pets behind, and that may be an obstacle for them seeking safety.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been known for some time that individuals who abuse animals occasionally and frequently go on to abuse people. Is this a piece of information that's just always kind of been there and been ignored, or has it always been like that?
Well, I think that those who spend most of their lives doing clinical work with individuals who have serious emotional and behavioral problems were very likely aware of this. If you look at some of the early psychoanalytic writings from the late 1800s, early 1900s, mm-hmm. There actually were case studies mentioned where an individual who had done something terribly violent toward another person, when you looked back into their childhoods, there were examples of animal abuse that were present there. But the first study that I actually found that specifically looked at children who were cruel to animals was done by a psychiatrist by the name of Fernando Tapia, who was then at the University of Missouri Medical Center. And that was published in 1971. And so it really is a fairly recent phenomenon in terms of concerted research.
Okay. But does it appear as though the incidence of this kind of thing has increased, or is it just we're more aware of it or more sensitive to it?
Well, that's an excellent question, Rita. I make a lot of parallels between the area of animal abuse and the area of child maltreatment. Until the 1962 publication of the Battered Child Syndrome in a medical journal, our country was really kind of oblivious to how serious a problem there was with child maltreatment. And once that paper was published, and then once doctors were mandated to report suspected child abuse, mm-hmm. We began to see ever-increasing cases. And we should be getting data, I think, this year on the fourth national incidence study on child maltreatment. Mm-hmm. In the area of animal abuse, we unfortunately don't have anything comparable. Mm-hmm. There is no national data collection system for cases of animal abuse. And so in some ways, we don't know if the problem is getting worse, getting better, or staying the same mm-hmm. because there's no baseline.
Well, if you were to listen to the news in our area in the last couple of months, you would think that it's an epidemic because of certain instances of, in one case, there was an individual who had horses that were being either aggressively abused or neglected. And then many, many people who are hoarders that then find, you know, it's just a different kind of pathology. It's not necessarily leading to violent behavior, but odd relationships to animals.
That's right. And I think you're making an excellent point because animal abuse is actually a quite diverse category. There are different forms of animal abuse. It ranges from the active forms of inflicting harm, in some cases where the person gets pleasure from it. There are actually cases where animals are sexually abused for the pleasure of the human perpetrator. And then there are those cases of animal hoarding, which have, in some instances, been tied to obsessive-compulsive disorder or other mental health problems. There was one study of animal hoarders that found that when the investigations occurred, many of the hoarders really were eligible for some kind of protective custody or guardianship. So, yeah, there's a wide range to this phenomenon.
It sort of leads to the next idea. Is there, I don't know how to put this without just sending off all kinds of political bells for people that I don't intend to send off, but are we looking and doing the kinds of things for our families that would help people raise their children to be more empathetic and less, you know, there's a border between when teasing is not really teasing, it's curiosity with small animals and with up from child to child, and where it becomes cruelty.
Yes, that too is a good point because there are many, you know, I guess everyone calls them teachable moments when young children especially are doing inappropriate things with animals. And typically there's a parent around or another responsible adult who can stop the behavior and then teach the child why it's wrong to do that and teach them appropriate ways of interacting with animals. But that, of course, requires time, and it requires someone who is responsible to be there with a child. And it also requires monitoring. And monitoring is a real challenge for many families these days with busy schedules, and that can be a challenge. The alternative is when children engage in this behavior, and rather than responsible adults being there to correct them, there may be less responsible peers who may actually reinforce that type of behavior. So there are some situational influences I think that sometimes may push kids in the wrong direction.
Because I can remember growing up half between the city and half between farms the family owned, and I was a challenge to keep an eye on. So, you know, they would find me, you know, following a snake who was desperate to get away from me, just kind of following it along to see where it was going to go and what it was going to do. And you don't necessarily have to be just a kid, a latchkey kid. You can be a real challenge to monitor, you know, just being a kid.
Oh, yes. And, you know, that's one of the dilemmas in the area of animal abuse is that for many, many years, we relied on parental reports to get information about whether or not children had displayed cruelty. And the problem is that a great deal of cruelty to animals occurs away from the eyes and ears of parents or other adults. And so we have to figure out ways of asking children themselves about their behavior.
Well, is there, when you have, in looking at human-animal and human-to-human relationships, once a cycle of cruelty has begun, and it's clear that this is not pranking, it's not an isolated incident, this is clear that someone has engaged in repeated behaviors that are not, would not be acceptable if they were known. How do you help that person? What can we do to be helpful?
Well, I think there are a number of ways. One of them, I think, that is very important is that we do have to have laws that make certain forms of animal abuse serious offenses, and not because we want to just dump all sorts of punishments on 10-year-old kids, but because in many instances, those laws will often include provisions for psychological evaluation of children, as well as some kind of treatment plan during a period of incarceration or a period of probation. And there are a number of programs that are directed toward children who are generally antisocial, not necessarily with animals, mm-hmm. that have been shown to be effective. And these programs are usually multi-systemic types of programs that work with the schools, they work with the family, they work with the child individually, they may work with peers. I think we have to be looking at those comprehensive types of interventions rather than just focusing on the animal abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to children who set fires. You know,
yes.
There are some kids who repeatedly set fires, sometimes quite dangerous and lethal fires. And the focus of the intervention for those children is typically not instruction in fire safety, dealing
mm-hmm.
with the symptom. It's trying to figure out why is the child doing this.
Yeah.
And getting at that issue. So I think we have to use the same approach in the area of animal abuse.
Is another benchmarking behavior bullying? I know there's been in the news for the last couple of years where bullying has led to some pretty dramatic pushback from the victim of the bullying.
Yeah, either pushback or in some cases such a high level of despondency that
mm-hmm.
some children take their own lives. So, yeah, it is a serious problem. I've done some work in Japan, and bullying, I think, is even a more significant problem in Japanese culture. And there are a lot of parallels between bullying and animal abuse, because in both cases you've got a big power differential
mm-hmm.
between the perpetrator and the victim. And, again, the successful programs seem to be programs that involve not only the child, but the school system as well as the family.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to say that the family is responsible for that behavior, because that may not be the case in some instances. But very clearly, the support of family members is needed to deal with that issue.
Okay.
There's actually a paper that will be appearing soon that specifically looked at the association between bullying and animal abuse and did find a correlation there.
So. Mm-hmm. Before we go any further, I want to remind the audience that this is a dialogue between our guest and you. And if you have something to share or an insight or a piece of information that might be useful to our listeners, I invite you to call at 217-333-9455. Or if you're out of the area, on our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. You mentioned, Professor, that there is a movement. People are attempting to get some kind of legislative assistance for this. How many states now have taken this kind of abuse, have looked at this and taken it seriously enough to create laws to help support activities of folks who are in the field working with this?
Well, there, I believe, are now 42 states that have passed felony-level
mm-hmm.
laws related to certain forms of animal abuse. And that's an enormous jump from 15, 20 years ago, when I think there were, you know, under 10 states that had felony animal abuse legislation. And I think the importance of having a felony law on the books is that law enforcement typically takes those types of crimes more seriously than misdemeanors. And there's also the possibility of having provisions for assessment and therapy, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a very positive step. I'm actually embarrassed to report that a law like that was proposed in the legislative session here in Utah just a month ago
mm-hmm.
and never made it out of the committee.
Ugh.
And so Utah is still one of those handful of states that only has a misdemeanor-level offense for animal abuse.
Mm-hmm.
The other legislative change that occurred about a year ago is that the state of Maine passed a law which now includes pets in protective orders that a victim of domestic violence.
Right. I saw that in your book.
Yeah, and soon after Maine passed that law, Vermont passed a similar law, as did New York. And I understand that during the legislative sessions that are going on around the country right now, there are a number of other states that are proposing similar types of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of a maturing of the field
right.
where our society is realizing that companion animals are often considered part of people's families.
Right.
And when they're threatened, the human members of the family may feel threatened also. So I think that's a positive change.
Yeah, something along the lines of, I'll run back into the house for my kids and my dog.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and I should mention to you, too, there's an organization called the American Humane Association.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the only organization nationally in this country that has both child welfare and animal welfare under one roof. They're an organization that dates back from the late 1800s. And they are very, very active in assisting with legislative programs like this. Mm-hmm. And they have a website, AmericanHumane.org, where people can get a lot of information about the links between animal abuse and human violence.
Well, we have some phone calls, and we'd like to just take them in order. We'll take our caller on line number one. Hello.
Hi. Hi, thanks for having this today.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of have a question about trying to build awareness and educate both children and adults. And I'm wondering, both in thinking of educational programs for kids, but also just general awareness, do you think it's more successful to focus on sort of the proactive aspects of teaching empathy and, you know, showing great relationships between humans and animals and one another, or focusing on the preventative aspects of, you know, showing what can happen when things go wrong? And the correlation I'm thinking about is when we think about dog bite prevention, a lot of educators might focus on, well, we need to prevent dog bites, and that's what they call it, and, you know, focus on things not to do in order to avoid being bitten. It sort of has a scary connotation. And then there are other educators who focus on, you know, this is the great things, these are good things to do with your dog, and sort of in a roundabout way, teaching people how to be safe. So I hope that makes sense, but I'm just curious which way you would recommend that organizations and educators go in this regard.
Very good question. I think that in part my answer is that programs that incorporate both approaches, I think, would be the way to go. For example, in terms of empathy development and learning how to care for others, I think that we take that process for granted because empathy usually is an outgrowth of experiencing being cared for yourself. And so anything we can do to make sure that children are cared for is probably going to increase their level of empathy. And there is research evidence showing that parents who foster that type of behavior in their children and who model it for them are more likely to have kids who are empathic toward others. With regard to programs like dog bite prevention, you know, I think it is critical that children learn about dangers, but as you said, they also need to learn about the positive messages that are there in terms of talking to an owner, should I approach your dog, how do I approach your dog, and so forth. There was a very successful program in Australia that has actually reduced children's inappropriate behavior toward dogs, especially strange dogs, by engaging in a classroom discussion, but also role-playing activities. And they actually tested the children by having kind of a Confederate dog show up on the playground, and the children who had been through this program were much less likely to engage in inappropriate behavior toward a strange dog than the children who were not educated about it. So I think both elements are critical to a successful program.
Okay, so in terms of building awareness about animal cruelty and domestic violence, we can have the sort of examples that we of cruelty that occurs, sort of, I don't want to say shock value, but sort of that end of it, but then also just modeling good relationships.
That's right.
Okay.
So in one of our studies, we actually asked children who were in homes where there was domestic violence, how they would like to see their animals treated. And, you know, these children who ranged in age from 5 to 17 were almost unanimous in saying, you know, we'd really like to see our animals treated better than they are. So the kids are aware of this, and they're they're aware of what needs to happen.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we have a caller on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. You were mentioning bullying just a few minutes ago and talked about the power differential between the bully and the bullied, I guess. And I'm a mother of a big, almost 4-year-old now, and I think he's probably always going to be significantly bigger than the other kids his age. And so far, he seems to have a really gentle nature. But I'm wondering, in kids that would have a tendency to bully, when would you start to see signs of that?
Well, I would suspect, and there is some research that looks at this, I would suspect that you might actually begin to see this in the preschool years. I would not be surprised if you went around the city, cities in Illinois, and asked daycare providers who have children 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age if there are children who they're concerned about bullying other children. You'd probably discover that they could easily come up with examples. So this is a behavior that can emerge early. Obviously, as children get physically stronger and more creative in their use of hurtful words, because we have to remember bullying can sometimes involve language rather than action. We can see that behavior emerge early, and that also gives us an opportunity to intervene early.
And the use of words rather than fists, is that more common among girls than among boys, or do you see that often among boys too?
Well, both types of bullying can occur regardless of the gender of the bully. But that's okay. There are studies indicating that girls are more likely to use relational types of bullying, the language, the spreading rumors, that type of thing. But boys aren't exempt. They're creative too, and will sometimes use that type of behavior as well.
Okay. Well, I think even you mentioned child care providers being able to pick up on small children who might have a tendency toward that. Even the other day, my son just out of nowhere said, named 2 boys in his class and said, they play too rough. They like to hit and things like that. So I think even the kids themselves can pick up on that really early.
That's right. I agree.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a caller on line number 4. Welcome. Hello, line 4.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it's not snowing out there like it is up here. It's really bad out here.
So. No, it's just raining and kind of nasty looking.
Oh, it's really nasty up here. So my question would, I actually got a couple comments. What I think is wrong, I disagree with some of the stuff that you guys are talking about. One is we got to start putting the blame back with the parents, responsibility. I'm tired of having regulations thrown on top of me saying what, you know, might be good for the guy next door is supposed to be good for me when it's not. I had pets. I had one die just not too long ago. So I needless to say, I don't have them. I've always treated my dogs and my kids with respect. But the ones I seem to have a problem with are the ones that have 2, 3, 4 kids in the house, go out and buy a cat or a dog or whatever kind of pet there is out there. 99% of the time, the parents walking the dogs and taking care of all animals and the kids not doing, you know, a darn thing. And I'm not trying to disrespect other people with their, you know, views on this, but the point being, if you can't handle your kids, you ought not to have pets, you know.
Oh, I agree with you. And, you know, in fact, I think that in some cases, animal welfare organizations may go to greater lengths to screen people who want to adopt an animal than we screen people who are going to have kids. So it's you're making a very valid point.
I mean, I just, the way our society is gone, it's like there's no responsibility left on the parents at all anymore. And I think, and every time there's a problem, and you know, the lady brought up petting, you know, or getting bit. Well, 9 times out of 10, I see the people that get bit, or the people that get bit, are the ones that don't teach their kids to go up to strange dogs. Because I've had this problem constantly with people with my dog. I had an Alaskan Mountain Mute, and she was as friendly as could be, but I was also paranoid about kids coming up and wanting to just do something and start petting. You know, they see, oh, it's, you know, what? And we educate the public like this by when we see nature shows, some of them don't explain, hey, you can't go up to these people. You know, everybody loves a teddy bear or a koala bear, but they don't know how vicious they are. And that's the problem with the education part of it, is you can't educate a kid enough. They've got an attention span of about 5 to 10 minutes, you know. But the parents don't want to spend the time. Of course, everybody's busy. But I thank you for this program because, to me, it makes, gives all people out there get a lot of knowledge, especially with kids. It just, it's ridiculous. I just dead set against regulations. That's all.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, my take on that is that the regulations aren't necessarily so much designed to be instead of the parents. It's when things have gone too far. Is
that's
that
right.
That's
rather
right. Than...
And, you know, as we talked about earlier, unfortunately, some instances of animal abuse do not occur in the presence of parents. And so if there are other adults around who can report that and who don't know the family, for example... it does get law enforcement involved and does get the attention of parents and guardians at
mm-hmm.
that point.
Right.
And in some cases, I think parents would welcome that information because how else would they know unless there were other members of the community who were kind of being watchful about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm wondering to some extent, I can remember as a kid, we grew up and everybody knew what you were doing. So you didn't get away with a whole lot, but we were still pretty crafty. And now people tend to be a little bit in isolation somewhat. And if I, for example, see something that I think might be a little off and I want to report it, I run a very serious risk of being sued.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Rita, because there actually is an ongoing large-scale study in your state, and I think mm-hmm. Elton Earls, who is probably someone you know, mm-hmm. Who is at Harvard, I think, coordinating this study, they found that neighborhoods where there was that sense of community and watchfulness of children, the rates of juvenile crime were lower in those communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important component, I think, of healthy environments for kids.
And we used to call that, when we were kids growing up, they were the grandmother eyes.
Yes.
Because it was not just your grandmother, it was everybody's grandmother.
That's right.
Because, you know, pretty much they were, like, at the window watching everything. But I think we might have been a little more entertaining than what was on TV at the time. When does the disconnect happen, Professor, when for example, when we were little, you know, it's using yourself as an example is always terrible, but, you know. We used to have snakes would go in the barn and we would kind of pull them out and we'd sort of like mess with them a little bit. And not to hurt, but just to kind of see what they looked like. And there were some that did wonderful things. They'd rear up and they'd pretend they were cobras and then they'd go back and hunt the mice that they really wanted. When does it stop being, gosh, this is a cool looking animal. What can I find out about it? And when does it turn into something else?
Oh, gosh, if we had the answer to that question.
Oh, the Holy Grail.
We'd be in great shape.
Okay.
You know, that's an excellent point because mm-hmm. There is some emerging research that is looking at the origins of psychopathy
mm-hmm.
In childhood. You know, usually we think of psychopaths as the serial murderers and other individuals like that who have committed a long series of heinous crimes. But there is some research that is actually discovering that in the early childhood years, you can actually find some children who have what are called callous and unemotional kinds of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Where they don't seem to be responsive to pain cues from other individuals. Their role-taking skills are not very good. And so some of that can emerge quite early in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for most kids, the intervention of a parent or an older peer who, you know, talks to the child about the suffering that the animal might experience and to treat it more appropriately,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be enough for most kids. But there's probably going to be that minority of children who require more intensive kinds of work to make that discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real challenge.
Yeah.
And it's not always related to family characteristics. I should say that.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some biological characteristics, There are some studies looking at neurotransmitter levels and its relation to violent behavior. So we have to be aware of all the possible factors. Not that these absolve people from responsibility, but the more we know about the phenomena, the better off we're going to be in terms mm-hmm. of trying to address it.
Well, one of the points that you made in some of the research and some of the articles that I have that you had written and co-authored was that frequently someone will harass an animal to get at somebody else, to control another person. And what comes to mind is a scene on a playground where you have children who might be a little more sensitive, who are, and there again, it's bullying. You got a dominant individual who maybe has trapped a wayward kitten or a small frog or something like that and is just harassing the life out of it. And the others are afraid to do anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that in cases like that, it actually is very similar to bullying, Rita, because mm-hmm. what we've, I think, finally realized is that in most instances, children cannot solve the problem of bullying by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They need adult assistance. And the successful programs that have addressed bullying have made clear to children that in many cases, you can't handle this yourself, and you're going to need the help of an adult. And it's not tattling, it's not ratting, but rather it's getting help,
mm-hmm.
Not only for the victim, but also help for the bully in some mm-hmm. cases. So I think in situations like that, where it may actually be dangerous for children to try to intervene themselves, they need to seek out an adult for assistance.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, too, about how we generally raise children. You know, you want your kids to be tough and you know, and I'm sort of go back to, you know, do we really need to raise every little kid to be a Spartan, you know, and either handle it yourself or just shell up when something bad happens so it doesn't touch you. If it hasn't touching you, it isn't you aren't to worry about it.
Well, you know, I think the answer there is that it actually does affect you.
Oh, yeah.
because, again, with bullying, one of the problems with addressing bullying is the fact that it is often maintained by the response of bystanders who sit there and either enjoy what's happening or simply don't intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when bullies experience no one intervening, it's as good as them being reinforced for what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a critical reason why we have to teach children that if it's not safe to intervene yourself, you really need to get an adult.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm assuming, maybe incorrectly, that for some people witnessing an event like that, that feeling that somebody else needs to do it or I can't do anything so I'm going to do nothing will kind of go with them into their adult life if there isn't somebody somewhere that intervenes and teaches them that there are ways of making something like this stop. I'm thinking of Kitty Genovese, who was stabbed to death on a street in New York with everybody watching. Everybody, nobody wanted to, you know, nobody knew what to do.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the whole issue of diffusion of responsibility mm-hmm. comes into play, yeah.
What can you do if you know of someone who is in an abusive relationship? And how do you assist a friend who might be in that situation or someone who is relentlessly watching a pet being abused?
Well, I think that one step, obviously, is education. And the education always has to be done with a great sensitivity to the safety of individuals and the family. For example, you know, the work that I've done and which has now been replicated by others indicates that about half of the women who go to domestic violence shelters who have pets report that their animals have been hurt or killed by their partner. So it's a fairly common experience for women with pets who have to seek out shelter at a domestic violence program. But reporting animal abuse and having a police officer or some other Humane Society officer show up on a doorstep can be a potentially dangerous scenario
mm-hmm.
for some victims of domestic violence. And so I always recommend that there be consultation with professionals in the domestic violence field
mm-hmm.
about how to not only get attention for the animal abuse issue, but to make certain that you're doing the utmost to guarantee that members of the family are going to be safe if there, in fact, a report is made and law enforcement gets involved.
Right.
So rely on those professionals mm-hmm. who are dealing with safety issues virtually every day with their clients.
Well, one of the things that is kind of creepy about the whole thing is if you're a pet lover, or I have house pets, and I appreciate others. Sometimes I'm a little put off by some, but you know, you like your pet, that's cool, you know.
Yes.
But it is just, I can't even fathom what it is that makes this happen. But by the same token, why would I beat a child? So, you know, and so I'm wondering in my head, is it all about power? Is this person who is the abuser, is there just such a missing piece there that they're so damaged and so brutalized by life, or something happened bad to them? Or, you know, can somebody who has never actually been abused turn into an abuser?
Well, no, I think I heard 12 questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. But, you know, in some ways, dealing with the issue of child maltreatment is easier because we don't have the species issue involved. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about animal abuse, we in human society have such different attitudes about which animals we respect and which animals we mm-hmm. hate and want to get rid of and don't care how they suffer in the process. And so it really complicates this issue. But even in the area of child maltreatment, I think you would find just as many motivations for abuse. You know, there are cases where parents have abused their children or in some cases killed them for insurance money. There are cases of Munchausen syndrome by proxy or factitious disorder by proxy where individuals either make it appear that their kids are sick or actually make them sick to get attention from medical personnel.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases where you have an uneducated young dad who doesn't know how to deal with a crying baby and eventually picks up the baby and shakes it so that it quiets down and unfortunately is brain damaged or worse. So the motivations and the scenarios that can create these problems are very diverse, and what that means is that in order to run effective prevention programs, we really need to get a handle on the various motives for these behaviors mm-hmm. and target our prevention and intervention in those particular cases. Mm-hmm. You know, now I think there are programs in Utah and other states that specifically target young adolescent parents and talk to them about shaken baby syndrome
mm-hmm.
and the ways to quiet a baby who seems inconsolable, even recommending, you know, put the baby on the floor and get out of the house.
Right.
If it's driving you crazy, the baby's not going to die from being on the floor,
mm-hmm.
but the baby might get harmed if you pick the baby up and shake it.
Right.
So all of that kind of research feeds into educational programs that hopefully will prevent some of these problems mm-hmm. from occurring.
Right. I can remember with small children, we had a 4-month colic baby. And for years, I couldn't imagine how anybody could harm a child. But, you know, once when they've screamed for 4 straight months because of something they're eating and you can't figure out what it is,
yeah.
If you don't have a support structure, you can see pretty quickly how that can happen, how somebody can get to the limit of their endurance.
Oh, sure. You know, a few nights without an appropriate level of
right.
sleep and we all begin to fall apart.
Yeah. And I can remember being incredibly grateful at the time. This was back in the 70s. We had a really good support structure on our block. Everybody had kids in roughly the same age bracket and no air conditioning, so they could hear when a baby had been screaming for hours and hours, and it was not at all unusual to find somebody had somebody else's child because it was like, I have no skin in the game. If this child is screaming, it's not like I have to make it quiet to show I'm a good parent.
That's right.
And it was extremely helpful, and I wonder if the way some of our communities are structured now, if we're losing some of that.
Well, I think we're losing it in the sense that some communities, including the one that I live in here in Logan, Utah, we have a child and family support center, and it provides respite care
mm-hmm.
for parents who are in that same kind of situation you described, but maybe are not connected to neighbors
mm-hmm.
and can't ask for help as easily as going to a program like theirs. Mm-hmm. So those are valuable resources because
right.
they really do benefit isolate families.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind our audience that we have two call-in numbers if you'd like to join the conversation. In the 217 area code, our number is 333-9455. And if you are out of the area, you can call us toll-free at 800-222-9455. This morning, in this first hour, we are talking about child and animal cruelty and the connection between those activities and intimate partner abuse with Professor Frank Ascione from the Department of Psychology at Utah State University. He's written many books, including Safe Haven for Pets, Guidelines for Programs Sheltering Pets for Women Who Are Battered. Professor, what was it? I'm kind of curious. This is a grim sort of, could be grim topic. And what was it that launched you into doing something about it and to researching it to help provide information probably?
Well, actually, you know, as a graduate student many, many years ago, I was always interested in the socialization of children and how that process works. And for a while, I actually was involved in a project evaluating a program in schools where children were taught responsible and nurturing treatment of animals. And after doing that research for a few years, a colleague of mine asked me what I knew about kids who were not kind animals, but rather kids who were cruel to animals. And I realized I didn't know a thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I had never encountered anything about this topic throughout my entire graduate training as a child psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly realized that my own discipline had kind of ignored this whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so that drew me into the older criminological research on this topic and some of the psychoanalytic and clinical studies that had been done with severely disturbed children and adults. And because, thankfully, animal abuse is a relatively uncommon behavior, I realized that I would probably have to go to environments where violence generally was higher.
Right.
And that's what led me to the area of domestic violence. I figured that if children were growing up in families where there was violence between the adults, if pets were present, they might sometimes be victimized as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was borne out in the very first study that I did. And so from there, in talking with women in our research, when we asked them about seeking safety at the shelter, a number of women would report that the reason they didn't come in sooner was they had nowhere to leave their pets, and their pets had been threatened either directly or implicitly by their partner, and they were frightened of leaving them behind, and that actually delayed going to the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And so that finding led me to look at whether or not domestic violence programs had something in place for women who wanted to come to a shelter but were concerned about what would happen to their animals if they had to leave them behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led to the whole Safe Havens book, which tries to compile kind of best practices for agencies that want to develop a program like that.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to impart today was that in next week, April 15th through the 21st, is Animal Cruelty Human Violence Awareness Week here in, possibly, is it a national thing or is it just in Illinois? I'm not sure either, Rita.
I don't know.
And two of our local agencies are offering their services to assist folks who might find themselves in one of these situations, and that one of them is the Champaign County Humane Society, dealing directly with the issue of what do I do with my dog or my cat who is in harm's way if I am gone or if I leave. Their number, for those of you who are interested in reporting abuse, is 344-7297. That's again 344-7297. They're also able to help you locate possibly some place where you can temporarily shelter your animal if you need to get away. And another phone number is A Woman's Place here in the area. Their number is 384-4462. Again, 384-4462. Those are regional or local resources for people who find themselves in a difficult situation or who find themselves witnessing a difficult situation and don't know what to do about it. You mentioned a little bit ago that we have a hierarchy of the kinds of animals we care about. And before I ask that question, there is a caller on line number one that we'd like to get to. Hello.
Sure.
Good morning.
Good morning.
By a great astonishment, I am told that we do have voodoo practices in our mm-hmm. community. And I'm wondering if you have looked into or done any study on the sacrificing and bloodletting and so forth that's done in voodoo, and that may not be the appropriate term, but I think I'm conveying what I'm talking about, with insult against animals.
Yes, I think you're probably referring to Santeria.
Yes, I am.
Which is a mixture of Afro-Caribbean religions.
Yes, I am.
Catholicism. And it's interesting, the case that was high profile occurred in the 1990s in Florida, where a local animal welfare organization wanted to consider those practices abusive toward animals.
Uh-huh.
And it eventually went to the Supreme Court.
Oh, my word.
States, and it was judged that those practices were considered acceptable within the practice of religion and the separation of church and
uh-huh.
state.
Okay.
So,
well, I was just curious because it seems to me that they're related to what you're talking about.
Well, it is. And you know what's worrisome about, regardless of what the Supreme Court has decided, what's worrisome to me is that in some cases the sacrifices are done on behalf of children
uh-huh.
or the needs of children, and sometimes children are present at these religious ceremonies.
Uh-huh. Well,
and,
but
you know, I grew up Catholic, and you know, we used to play being priest, and and I wonder if children who are exposed to these practices
yes.
ever decide, you know, well, let me play this out when the parents are not around
yes.
and do that with other animals. So,
well, there was I'm a Law and Order buff, and there was a section on that, and then I was talking with it about several people, and he said, well, right here in our community, you know, we have this practice. So I'm very interested in your being aware of it and having looked into it and being alert to the Florida situation.
Yes, and in fact, if you contact an organization like the American Humane Association,
uh-huh.
They may have some literature that
okay.
can pass along related
well,
to
well, I understand it's in that Never Never Land, but, you know, the effect it would have on, as you say, children who see this as a part of life
That's right.
Is worrisome.
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Sure enough.
Thank you. What can someone who's in an abusive relationship do if he or she can or cannot leave?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm probably not the best person to
okay.
help that, Rita.
Okay.
I think that I would defer to the local domestic
violence
agency
people.
Mm-hmm. in the community. And they are ready to deal with confidential
mm-hmm.
phone calls or confidential communications. They are very, very aware of safety issues. You know, I've noticed going to some domestic violence sites on the Internet
mm-hmm.
That many of the sites that deal with domestic violence will now have a warning for the person using the computer telling them, you know, you have to be careful because someone can go back and look at what sites you visited.
Mm.
And if you're concerned about your safety, you know, don't enter this site because there will be a record of
right.
where you've been. You might want to go to a library and use a computer there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that those people who every day have to deal with these safety issues are the ones who are
mm-hmm.
best equipped about providing advice to people in their particular circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So of all of the places and all the things that we've talked about and the issues raised by some of our callers, if you were to have the listener remember just one thing, what would that be?
Well, I think the one thing would be not all children who abuse animals are destined to become criminals.
Right.
We have to realize that animal abuse is sometimes part of the growing up activity of young children. But it's critical for parents, other responsible adults, to always intervene when they see animal abuse and to provide the positive teaching that children need in those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And the other piece of advice is that if you've done this, you've tried this, and you still find that your child is appearing to enjoy hurting animals, seek some professional help.
Okay. And I'd like to pass along those two phone numbers again, the two local resources quickly. A Woman's Place phone number is 384-4462, and the Champaign County Humane Society, 344-7297. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it. This is a difficult subject, but you outlined for us some positive things that are coming out of the research into this.
Well, it was a pleasure to be part of the show, Rita.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, and I'd like to thank our callers, and again to thank our producer, Harriet Williamson, our associate producer, Martha Deal, and our technical director, Henry Frain, for helping us this morning with the program. And coming up in the second hour of Focus 580 at 11 o'clock, a program from the Focus 580 archives, David Inge will talk with Sarah Igo, assistant professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, about her book, The Averaged American: Surveys, Citizens, and the Making of a Mass Public. Thanks to all of you who called in this morning. We appreciate your participation.